Hi guys. The Undisclosed team is currently deep in the weeds of season 2, but I'm glad we were able to come back today and record this bonus episode. It's going to be weird not talking to y'all every week, and I can't wait until we're back later this year. Before we start though, a quick plea. If you've enjoyed the podcast, and if you believe that justice was not done when Anand Syed was convicted, before you listen to today's episode, please consider making a donation of even just a dollar to Anand's legal defense fund. Anand's case has come a long way, but it is far from over yet, and the state will be doing everything it can to affirm his conviction. More than ever, his defense needs the resources to present his defense at the upcoming hearing and in the appeals that will likely follow. Donations can be made at launchgood.com to the Anand Syed Trust, and we'll also have a link up on our website at www.undisclosed-podcast.com. And a huge thanks to everyone who has already donated both to the Anand Syed Trust Fund and to the podcast. It has made more of a difference than you know, and Anand could not have gotten this far without you.
Almost every week since April of 2015, the Undisclosed team has brought you a new episode. In our over 30 episodes, we've dissected every part of the state's case, examined every bit of information we could get our hands on, analyzed every document in the case files, and followed every new lead possible. And even now, while we've wrapped up our reporting on his case, our work behind the scenes isn't quite over yet. Not only are we still investigating, we are in fact sitting on information best suited for a court of law and not a podcast. And as Adnan's case and investigation progresses, we will continue to give updates when necessary, so don't worry, we aren't quitting this case, not by a long shot. Now, our awesome listeners have suffered through hundreds and hundreds of tiny factual details and serious, tough, deeply involved legal questions. We know that Undisclosed is not easy listening, so the fact that you all came back week after week for more says volumes about our audience. It says our audience takes these issues seriously and that they understand the tremendous impact the flaws in the justice system has on the lives of real people. So, since you have all traveled this far with us, we wanted to gift our listeners a bonus episode, our small way of saying thank you for all your support. But don't worry, this one will be easy listening, as we have a great conversation with Rebecca Lavoie, who's a true crime author and podcast host of Crime Writers on Serial, and also happens to be our own awesome production consultant.
We hear at the beginning of every episode, Rabia tells us that she's joined with or by Susan and Colin. And, you know, we know about you guys as listeners. We know about you guys as lawyers. We know about you in terms of your connections to this case. Susan, I want to start with you. Tell us just a little bit about yourself that we don't know. You know, where did you grow up? Where did you go to law school? What made you decide to become a lawyer? What made you start blogging? Just give me sort of the elevator pitch of your life, if you don't mind.
I'm from Georgia originally, grew up there. I went to college at Agnes Scott in Decatur, and I ended up going to law school probably because of the same reason a lot of people do, and it's not a good reason. It worked out in my case, but mostly I got to senior year and didn't really know what I was going to do. I think I didn't want to go to law school because my dad's a lawyer, and just for whatever reason, that made me rule it out pretty early on. But then senior year came around, I'm like, well, I should apply. Did well in the LSATs, decided to go. It's a terrible reason. No one should ever go to law school like that. But it worked out. So I went to GW in D.C. and ended up staying here.
Did you blog before the serial case? Did you maintain a blog about different aspects of the law?
No. So in law school, I had a good friend of mine. We were moot court partners, did a lot of international law stuff together just for fun. And once we graduated, obviously, in real life, there's less time to do fun legal research projects. So in 2009, after we graduated, we decided to start a blog together just for fun to talk about all the stuff we couldn't do now in our daily jobs. He had to retire from the blog for professional reasons, but I'm hoping, hi, Michael, that one day he'll come back and join us.
What made you decide to start blogging about Adnan Syed's case?
I started listening to it, and there was a lot of questions I had, which is kind of how I blog about anything. And I just wanted to get a better feel for what was trying to... Actually, it was less the legal stuff and more just me trying to piece together what exactly Sarah was talking about, because she never really presents like a A, B, C, D steps of the whole thing. So I was trying to piece that together, and it kind of went from there.
So Colin, how about you? Can you give us the same sort of thumbnail sketch of your life?
Yeah, I grew up in Virginia Beach, about 15 minutes away from the beach. I went to college at the University of Virginia and law school at William & Mary. I talked about this a bit on the Tina episode. My grandfather was in World War II. He came back and was diagnosed with MS, and then on his own sort of read up on the law himself and had this protracted battle with the VA before getting benefits based upon the war-induced disability. That, combined with watching a number of legal films, 12 Angry Men, The Thin Blue Line, Witness for the Prosecution, I was always, from an early age, interested in being both a lawyer and a teacher, and pursued that by going to law school and practicing for a few years, and then making that transition to becoming a law professor. In terms of my blog, I started that right when I started teaching in 2007. I was a big fan. There's this whole network of law professor blogs. There wasn't one for evidence. And I've always been interested in the fairness of proceedings. And that's what the rules of evidence are all about. It's about fairness to the people involved in a case. And so the genesis of that blog was sort of a place where I could comment on developments in the law, cases, and really how the rules of evidence operate to both a legal audience and a lay audience.
So what do you think of the film Reversal of Fortune? Was that on your list of films that you watched that made you want to be a lawyer?
Yeah, that was on the list too. Reversal of Fortune was a big one. I mean, the one, in addition to all those fictional ones that I just mentioned a second ago, The Thin Blue Line, that's Errol Morris. He also did another one called Dr. Death or Mr. Death about basically the person responsible for a lot of the technology and techniques that are used in the death penalty, and sort of a fascinating story. But yeah, looking at all those real-world and non-real-world examples, it was something that just from an early age, I did debate in high school and forensics, extemporaneous speaking and impromptu, and everything. I feel like my whole educational experience was guiding me in the direction of a legal career.
In terms of, you know, your teaching now, do your students know you do this podcast? I assume they do.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like every day I'll have a student coming in and they'll say that they listen to the podcast and oftentimes have ideas or thoughts. And I use it in class, not excessively, but certainly when we discuss the very same topics we talk about in the podcast, whether it be chain of custody or whether it be polygraphs or hearsay, I'll mix it into the class and use it as a relevant example.
All right. So, Rabia, we hear you introduce yourself every week. We know you from being introduced by Sarah Koenig in Serial. We know that your family are family friends with Adnan's family. We know that you're a fellow at the New America Foundation. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. What does that mean?
What does that mean?
Yeah. What does the rest of your life look like? You know, we know a little bit about where you grew up because you've mentioned it sometimes. But, you know, the rest of your, you know, without getting too into areas you don't want to talk about, you know, what does your life story look like outside of this pursuit of justice here?
Yeah, I mean, Adnan's case has never been part of my professional career at all. It's just been kind of a personal, I don't know what, but it's been part of my personal life more than anything, I think. So, you know, when New America Foundation is one of the different kind of consulting types of work that I do. Starting next year, I'll be doing a fellowship with the U.S. Institute of Peace, also kind of in the same vein. And I'm a national security fellow. So my work has transitioned from legal practice. About 4 or 5 years ago, I began working in national security policy. And that's in direct response to issues of online recruitment, radicalization, our national security response to Muslim communities, engagement. And this comes not as a sudden transition, but because for at least the last 10 years, I have been in some kind of advocacy role in the Muslim community. So, you know, even before Undisclosed, before Adnan's case and Serial and all this, you know, I had been writing publicly, speaking publicly on lots of different issues that are just kind of connected to diaspora Muslim communities. And so, you know, my national security work is really focused on how to engage faith communities on issues of national security. I mean, what are the lines? What are the civil rights concerns that are raised? You know, how should government approach this? How should law enforcement engage on these issues? And that's really the bulk of my work.
So very, very timely work. You know, not only has your advocacy for Adnan sort of come into focus, but I'm sure that your professional life in that sphere is also, you're probably in a lot of demand in that sphere as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, just there are so many layers to these issues. I mean, the very specific realm I work in is called CVE, which is Countering Violent Extremism. And much of the work I was doing with New America Foundation focused on just providing social media advocacy skills to Muslim organizations and leaders across the country. And basically, you know, how do you fight back? Because a lot of this stuff is happening online. A lot of the really negative stuff, whether it's terrorist recruiting or it's anti-Muslim bigots, they kind of are an echo chamber. And just recently after the San Bernardino shooting, again, I got many, many requests to talk about this and to come and do our trainings. We have like an entire day's worth of training we do on these issues. So it keeps popping up, and I look forward to the day that none of this is necessary anymore.
You all came together. Maybe, Rabia, you can give me a quick thumbnail sketch of how this idea for the genesis of this podcast came together. I know that Susan and Colin had both, they were both blogging about the case, and that's how you initially made contact with them. But how did you decide to do a podcast and bring these two in? And I'd love to hear from Susan and Colin, too, and sort of thinking about making that transition and trying it out, what you guys thought about that.
I haven't even met Colin yet.
That's something that I've always wanted to know. Like, do you guys know each other at all off the air, or is this your whole relationship is inside this podcast?
I see Rabia. I mean, we see each other sometimes.
We've hung out. Yeah, we're in the local area, so we've hung out a few times.
But you haven't seen Colin in person, either one of you?
I haven't met Colin either. No.
Wow.
No, I've never met Colin. I wonder if I would ever pass him in the airport and be like, is that him? That's what he looks like in his profile picture. No, but what happened was, you know, both of their blogs, I think, were posted on Reddit. And I started reading their blogs, and I'm like, who are these people? And especially with Susan's first couple of blogs, I don't know if, I'm sure she remembers, but they were like, I mean, when I tried to print them up for Adnan, they were like over 40 pages long. It was incredibly detailed.
You printed them for him?
I did. Yeah, I did. I wanted him to see, like, first of all, look at this craziness, but, you know, this the amazing amount of, like, you know, work you put into it. I was so just impressed. And so at some point, I reached out to both of them and I said, listen, you guys are, you know, doing these amazing blogs based on like what I've made public, the documents, but I can share all the case files with you. You know, so you can just get into it and go with it. And they're both very highly skilled in terms of investigation and analysis, way beyond me. And so I did that. And I don't think I still had met Susan yet. But the idea for the podcast came because I was doing a lot of talks around the country about the case. And I happened to do one in D.C. and Susan was there. And one of our trustees from the legal fund was there. And I always used to ask the question, you know, how many people read my blog? How many people read Susan's blogs? Because I always get an idea of where the audience is at. And, you know, very few people, as compared to listening to Serial, were actually reading our blogs. So they were missing out on a lot of information. And right afterwards, Dennis was like, you guys should just put your stuff together and do a podcast. And my initial reaction was like, right, whatever. I mean, like, it was like, you know, one more thing. And
we were like, that's a great idea. How hard can it be?
Well, Susan jumped like right on it. I think within like 3 days, Susan's like, I've got a logo. Here's some titles. And I'm like, oh my God, is this happening?
You know, I think I imagined that podcasting would be like just a little bit different than blogging. Yeah, it worked out, but I was probably being kind of naive about our ability to pull this off.
Well, how have you felt about pulling it off? I mean, I'd love to hear from Colin. I mean, you talk for a living. I'm assuming you prepare lectures, or at this point you know, sort of have your book of lectures prepared. You sort of deliver information for a living. How is doing a podcast, delivering it for broadcast form, different from what you do? And what were some of the challenges that you felt you were encountering when you first started out?
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty similar in the sense that we, before each episode, prepare an outline. It's not a script, at least after the first episode or so. And that's the launching pad. We use that as basically the starting point where we get our ideas and what to discuss. And I do a very similar thing in my classes. I do all the background work. I try to bring in recent cases and developments in the law, but it's not any type of script. And it's very much a dialogue between myself and the students in the classroom. That's sort of in law school, what you do is the Socratic method, where it's a series of questions where you change the facts of the case a little bit and allow the students to see whether that changes the outcome. And I feel like as we've progressed with the podcast, that's a lot of what we're doing, where we have these ideas, we bounce them off of each other, and sometimes we agree, sometimes we disagree. But I think both amongst ourselves and then interacting with our audience on social media and through the podcast, it's really helped us to, I think, get closer to the truth, disregard things that end up not working out, see when people really react and think, oh, that's a really good theory, maybe you should pursue that more. And I think through that process, we've been able to rule certain things out and possibly rule certain things in. And I think it's been very helpful in the investigation.
Colin, do you remember how you got involved in the podcast?
I do. I think that one of you emailed me, and the idea at first, from what I recall, was you two would be doing the podcast, and I would sort of contribute like the Law Professor Corner, where there'd be like sort of a 5-minute segment where I would summarize one of my blog posts or something. And then I think one of you decided, well, no, let's, it makes more sense. Let's just do this big group discussion. But I think the original idea was just I would have like the Law Professor Corner, and here, separate from you two, I just would discuss whatever I wanted to on a given episode.
I just remember messaging you on Reddit. I'm like, me and Robbie are making a podcast. You're in, right? And you were like, sure.
Yeah, why not, right?
Why not? And Susan, I'm curious. You mentioned sort of talking about the undertaking and sort of what it takes. I, first of all, full disclosure, have never met any of you guys except talking to you through a microphone. You know, I talked to you about production, that kind of stuff. And, you know, Susan, I know that you sometimes feel like you have to evolve a little bit in terms of like your vocal delivery. I know that's one of the things that you think about a lot. I don't really think you should worry about that kind of stuff because
I was not born to be a podcaster. I will not be offended by being told that.
Yeah, but tell me what some of your thoughts have been as you started the process. What were some of the things you didn't expect, and what are some of the things that you've had to then think about that are different than the things you've had to think about for your day job?
It's very different from anything I've done before. Obviously, as a litigator, you do court appearances, you do writing, you do depositions, but the skills aren't, for me anyway, they don't seem like much of an overlap because the purpose behind each is so different. I did not probably expect us to get as popular as we did. I may have been a bit more daunted had I thought we'd actually do well, but it's been interesting for me because I'm not a great presenter, and doesn't bother me, never tried to be, but now I'm in a role where I'm forced to try and do that. I've tried to improve, done my best. I've gotten lots of feedback. Thank you, iTunes reviews. I've tried to slow down. And this is me slowed down. That's the sad thing. But
I do notice that you are slower when you're answering a question or responding and sort of talking off the cuff than you are when you are reading something that you've prepared or talking about something that you've prepared. It's like my sense is that you really want to get to the thing that you want us to know when you've sort of laid it out. But when you're sort of interacting, I've noticed there is a difference. But I don't think it's something you need to worry about. And I don't think you should pay attention to those podcast reviews. But
well, yeah, it's kind of for me. It's most the I don't mind the reviews because they're just reviews, but some people take it really crazy far. Like I've had people that will write pretty long emails detailing why, and this weird kind of sense of entitlement too. Like I demand a better product. I want the podcast without you on it for all of these reasons. And
oh
we'll
my
send
God.
It and we'll find not only just into one email because I control like the undisclosed email. So I'll send it to like there and then they'll track down my personal emails and send it to all those as well, just to make sure I get it. I'm like, really?
Yeah. Oh, I do think the difference in Rabia, this is something that you might be able to address because you do have this background in engagement and public engagement. There is something with podcasting where people do feel like they know you because you are in their ear, which is a very different experience than watching somebody on TV and, you know, reading a book that somebody wrote or hearing somebody speak. You know, I work in radio. I'm also an author. I definitely have the most engagement online through email, personal interaction from my podcast of anything else that I've ever done. I don't know how my audience for the podcast compares numbers wise to anybody who might know me in any other medium, but it feels very, very personal. The emails I get feel personal. They feel like they know me and Kevin. They feel like, oh, I want to hang out with you. But have you noticed a difference in engagement now that the podcast has started? Just the way that people feel comfortable engaging with you, has it changed?
Oh, gosh. I mean, yeah, it's really, I mean, first of all, I mean, Twitter is a really fascinating medium, but I get dozens and dozens and dozens of private messages either on Facebook and Susan's right. Well, like I manage the social media for Undisclosed. So somebody might want to send a message to me like on Facebook message, but then also email me through my blog and then through my PR website. And what's interesting is like the familiarity that some people will have. Like there's a couple of people on Twitter who I don't know who they are, but they're always like, how are you feeling today? I mean, like it's so intimate and like, and I try to be as responsive as possible because I enjoy social media and I'm on it a lot. I've always been on it a lot. And, but it's a whole different thing. And the weird thing is because before Undisclosed, most of my social media content was really focused on kind of these American Muslim issues, right? Like you know, the ones that everybody knows about. And that and my cat, Mr. Beans, which, like, is the cornerstone of my social media.
I believe he has his own Facebook page now, correct, Mr. Beans?
He's had a Facebook page for a number of years now. I mean, so I, you know, he's always deserved it. He deserves a Twitter account. I just don't have the capacity at this point. But so it's interesting. It's really expanded my following. I think when Serial began, I had like 12 or 13,000 followers on Twitter, and I'm approaching 40,000. And now it's all kinds of people. And they seem to be very much attuned to what's happening, even my life personally. So yeah, it's very conversational. And you know, when I'm traveling, I'll have people say, if you're going to be in the city, you know, let me know, like tweet at me. And I have met up with Twitter fans before and had coffee and had lunch and hung out. And so it's kind of a cool community that's grown up around it.
How about you, Colin? I follow you on Twitter. I see you tweet a lot about case law. I see you respond to a lot of queries. And one of the things that I was curious about you is you are in academia, like, you know, I mean, for lack of a better way of putting it, I'm sure you're more nuanced than this, but you probably typically know when people are just like way off base about something legal and when they sort of are in the ballpark, and you respond to a lot of legal questions. How is the engagement part and being on the podcast? How do you like it? I mean, is it weird? Does it just feel like you've now expanded your classroom hugely? Does it make you uncomfortable sometimes when you see people sort of like who suddenly feel like they're experts in the law when you actually are an expert in the law and you're just on Twitter and you're trying to respond to those questions?
Yeah, I think you kind of nailed it when you said that it sort of is me expanding the classroom. When I first started listening to Serial, I thought this is a great opportunity for people who don't know much about the law to really learn about it and become educated, because really a key to the jury system surviving and being a logical way to decide guilt and innocence is the populace being educated about the law, what goes on, how things work and how they don't work. And that was a big reason why I started blogging about it. It is a big reason why I decided to do the podcast. And yeah, I think that the social media engagement, it is people who are very interested in the law. They're curious about things like Brady or the Jenks Act or grand juries. So I think this is really a great learning experience for people around the country to get that insight into exactly what they might be involved in one day as a member of a jury.
Does it feel weird or cool to hear people just in the vernacular now on Reddit or on other platforms say things like that have clearly come from this podcast, like, oh, that's classic Brady? Like, like people who you know are not lawyers who now just they're just really well versed and they could be like, oh, classic Brady. Does that feel good?
Yeah, and it's I'll get it over email or social media, people pointing out, oh, here's a case in New York where the prosecutor failed to turn over this confession, or here's a case out of California that involved lividity evidence. And yeah, it's really interesting to see people who might have had no engagement with the law before, as a result of the podcast, right, they are pretty well versed and they understand when something comes up and they can spot the significance. So it's great. It's sort of Undisclosed, I feel, is a bit like a mini law school where people could listen to it and have a general sense of kind of what goes on in the criminal justice system.
One thing I love is not just people who aren't lawyers learning things, it's lawyers learning things. Like after we had our discovery episode, I heard from so many civil litigators, people doing civil stuff only, who wrote me and were like, wait, what? Criminal litigation doesn't involve full discovery? This is a thing? It's just one of those things that a lot of lawyers don't encounter in their careers if they're only doing civil stuff. They never had reason to know, and it's pretty common they wouldn't know how severely limited and in many respects unfair criminal discovery is in comparison.
I want to pivot now and talk about the case that you guys have been talking about for 30-some-odd episodes of radio, really, in these podcasts. And the thing that brought you together and the thing that I think it drew your initial audience to you, although I suspect as you continue on with this and look at different cases, you know, that audience that loves hearing this legal stuff will stay. I'm going to start with you, Susan, because, you know, one of the things that you are sort of famous for in this podcast is saying, like, just when I think I've seen the craziest thing in this case that I've seen, I find something else. And that's the kind of thing I hear you say a lot. So if you had to pick just one crazy fact, one crazy thing that you've come across in your deep dive into this case, what would be the one thing that for you would rise to the top?
Well, I always do say, well, nothing's going to surprise me more at this point. And then I always end up being wrong. So that's probably why I keep saying that, because I think you think you've seen it all. And no, this case does have so many wrinkles.
Colin, would you like to answer that question?
Yeah, I'd say for me, the craziest part is just Christina Gutierrez. You know, we had that long episode about her life and career, but just to see someone who rose so quickly, so fast, and then had this sharp decline, and we're still trying to make sense of it. You know, obviously, we have almost $300,000 from clients that's missing. We have all these balls that were dropped in these cases at the end of her career. We have some leads. We can't really report on them now. We might, in the near future, be able to say more about it that might help to explain things more. But I think just looking at the case and the number of times you have judges who are asking her, you know, how can this make any sense that someone who works as hard as you do drop this ball or that ball, whether it be failing to look at the key cell phone evidence in the case? It's just, she's just such a mystery. People say Jay's a mystery, and certainly he is, his motivations, et cetera. But for me, Gutierrez, she is the huge question at the heart of the case and exactly what was going on with her at the time of the trial.
Hmm. What about you, Rabia? I know that you probably have a lot of opinions here, but can you distill it to one moment or one fact or one misstep or one mistake that you see having been made that you would just say that is the craziest thing about this case? I think it's singular in that way.
I mean, I think one of the most important discoveries that Susan and Colin, I think it was Susan, made actually, that explains so much about the case and would have completely, I think, changed on Ted, was the lividity evidence. But having said that, that wasn't my greatest WTF moment. My greatest WTF moment was when Susan told me about the taps, the tapping sound that occurs when Jay is being interrogated by the police, which, you know, for all the mystery that Jay was, completely solved the mystery for me. You know, it suddenly all made sense, all the different stories, his role in all of this. The taps were just, I mean, they still blow my mind. But, you know, the taps alone don't necessarily speak to what actually happened on January 13th. And for that, I'd say the biggest thing was the lividity evidence.
The lividity evidence was certainly, I think, a big turning point for your podcast where, and again, you mentioned that you knew a lot of people who weren't reading your blog, were listening to the podcast, and you sort of were able to put something out there on the airwaves in the same place that people who first listened to Serial heard it. That is a big piece of evidence for the case. Susan, piecing that stuff together, was there for you, like the WTF that, you know, as Rabia phrased it, where, you know, you sort of realize this means this. I can draw this line and this could potentially change everything. Did you have that feeling that, you know, as we call it in the writing sphere, that like, oh, shit moment?
Well, with lividity evidence, that's an interesting one. It wasn't me actually who found it. It was actually two different people following the case. They were both actual real life doctors. One I got in touch with on Reddit and one was emailing me from my blog. And this was before we had most of the documents in the case. And just based on like the first transcript, the first trial and the medical examiner's testimony, they were talking about like kind of weird gaps or things that weren't really well explained in the way that she was testifying. And they'd mentioned like, this kind of doesn't add up. If the lividity was on her front, was she buried on her front? And if not, that's going to be a huge problem. So when I finally did get the documents from Rabia, that was one of the things I kind of zoomed in to look at. And when I saw that, well, no, the autopsy report says she was buried on her side and the lividity's in the front, I mean, that was kind of an oh shit moment, because what they'd been saying would be a problem here was right there in black and white. I should also mention, because it's interesting, when Rabia first emailed me and Colin and was asking if we wanted to see the documents, I remember trying to convince her not to, or saying, like, are you sure you want to do this? This is a really dumb idea, giving two people you don't know full access to the case files when they're independent bloggers. And Rabia had no problem with it. She said, I like what you're doing. Here you go. Keep going for it.
That seems to be part of who Rabia is. You know, if you think about the way this whole thing came to be, it's this idea of sort of like, yeah, here's the box of stuff. Take a look. Have at it. Maybe you'll see something I haven't, you know, which brings me to you, Colin. I mean, one of the things that has really happened, like a big phenomenon of this case, is a new level, I think, of crowdsourced investigation, crowdsourced theorizing, sometimes, you know, for with positive results, sometimes with no results, and sometimes just kind of spinning into conspiracy theory land, you know. I'm wondering if, I mean, that's just me observing, by the way, some of the conversations that I see out there. And I've said it many times, and I'll give you full disclosure, I don't think anybody knows what happened. I don't know what happened. I know what I think, but I know that I don't know. And it seems like sometimes people out there, especially online, really feel like they know. And I'm wondering if you've ever seen something like a crazy argument made that someone said that this definitely proves that Anand's guilty. You know, take all this other evidence, take it off the table, just look at this one thing. Like, as an evidence professor, I'd be curious to know if you've seen stuff out there that you can't believe that somebody would put in writing like that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's something where there's evidence where people have said this definitely points to guilt that I would highlight. What I would highlight is, piggybacking off what we were discussing, is the lividity evidence. And when that came out and we started writing and talking about it, the lengths to which certain people went to try to explain away lividity. There were people who did 3D diagrams, and they sort of did these poses where they tried to explain, well, she could have been on her right side, but then the top of her body was parallel to the ground, and they did sort of these Barbie doll diagrams where bodies just don't move that way. People tried to claim that, well, she was found on her right side, but maybe, you know, rain could have caused erosion of the soil underneath her. So initially she was face down, but then that shifted the body. And it was just all these attempts to explain away the evidence because, I mean, it's pretty clear. We've all talked to a number of forensic pathologists and medical experts. They've all been consistent and said there's no way that anything close to the state's narrative makes sense with the lividity. So you kind of have to try to explain that away. And, you know, the attempts, they really don't make much sense, but a lot of people who have been convinced of guilt and still tried to maintain the 7 o'clock timeline have really gone to great lengths in trying to explain away that evidence.
That's all worth considering too, but there's a lot to look at there because it is, in some respects, it's a very simple issue because it is right there, literally black and white in the autopsy report. It looks like it's so plain, but it's so huge to the case itself that it's worth looking at every possible option, which at this point I think we have. And unless there was some serious, serious documentation problems from various levels of the investigation, from like detectives to the ME to anyone else involved at the crime scene, I mean, the paperwork has to be wrong or the burial was not at 7.
What about you, Rabia? Have you seen somebody out there, you know, try to explain away things or try to prove something based on something that was just beyond the pale?
You know, I think what's something that dawned on me as Serial was ongoing, and I just didn't consider it before, was the fact that, it's interesting that Sarah kind of opened Serial and framed it kind of, do you remember what you did 6 weeks ago? Whereas in hindsight, if I were to try to frame it, I would frame it in terms of like confirmation bias, because a lot of what people base their, and myself included, you know, their conclusions about Anand's guilt or innocence is really just a reflection of our own feelings about him in many ways. You know, I mean, so things like the I will kill note, or did he ask for a ride? I mean, they can be completely innocent if you think he's innocent. But if you just have a really strong bias against him for whatever reason, you don't like his voice, you don't like the way he responded, you don't like what you heard, those are damning pieces of evidence. And so, for me, this has been a really interesting, because going into this, you know, when Sarah started investigating and started the podcast, I literally thought, I mean, this is how stupid I was, this is going to run and the whole world's going to be like, oh my God, he is so innocent, without realizing that there are these ambiguities that people, depending on their own reactions to this, their own experiences, whatever, are going to just interpret very differently. So, you know, I think people who feel very strongly about his guilt are going to see everything as evidence of his guilt. If he cried after she died, that means he must have been remorseful, right, for killing her. I mean, so that's kind of been the lesson for me in this, is just kind of an experiment on our own human biases.
You know, one of the things I was talking about with someone who works in my newsroom recently was about how Sarah framed Serial, and the real-time reporting really made her stray from that original frame. I think my opinion is that she also thought it was going to be about the tenuousness of memory and sort of the, you know, the connections that you make that turn out to not really have relevance in a story, and that's why there's so much ambiguity. And then as with the real-time reporting, a lot happened that sort of changed the story, made it take a right turn. And if you've listened, I'd love to hear from each of you. If you've listened to episode one of this season of Serial, which I suspect is much more framed out and in the can than last season of Serial was, I think she very definitively in this first episode told us what it was going to be about. She said, this is about a big thing, which I promise we will talk about, and we're going to begin right here, but I promise we're going to go to this other place. Do you think this was a lesson she learned from that real-time reporting and from the way this played out? Maybe she had a plan too, Rabia, that didn't go anything like how she expected it to go. I mean, you've met her. I mean, you could probably give us some insight on that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, I'm not saying that the memory aspect, I think that's a really important thing to think about because of the way that Adnan's case was investigated by the police is that, of course, people's memories fail and fade and get confused. And that is a perfectly legitimate framing also. But with Sarah, you know, there were a couple of different things that I think that really kind of had to force her to do Serial the first season a certain way. And it was, number one, the real-time reporting. Number two, the fact that she had to maintain certain relationships because she was still hoping that people like Jay or other people would come back to her, reach out to her. She needed to keep doors open, right? So there was like this sense of not having too much conclusiveness about certain things because she couldn't close certain, she, you know what I mean? I mean, and that goes again to the real-time reporting. With this first episode of the second season, I completely agree with you, Rebecca. I think that's what's going to happen. She's going to zoom out as she's talked very specifically about the whole Zoom book. And I'm really fascinated to see where this goes. I happen to have a little bit of insider information on just the background of some of the dealings that happened with Bergdahl's case and the negotiations. And I don't know all of it, but I, you know, from what I've heard, there's a lot of things that's never been reported in the public. And I'm hoping that that is where Sarah is able to take us. And it's a pretty fascinating story. But I mean, if you go back and listen to, I think, the very first episode of the first season, Sarah says, I'm not an investigative journalist. I'm not a crime reporter. She's a storyteller. And, you know, it just so happened that the first season turned out to be kind of crime solving and investigative, whereas I think this one might be more about a story.
Colin and Susan, first of all, did you either one of you want to add to what it was Rabia just said about season two's framing versus season one?
I think what you mentioned earlier was right about how Sarah framed it that way in the first episode, but that framing kind of got abandoned later on. And I think it's a huge part of the story that didn't really get explored enough. And I think one thing that I would like to see us as a podcast push back against and that I don't think we actually have because it's so ingrained is this idea that eyewitness testimony or witness testimony is objective fact. And it is to a certain degree, but memory is so valuable. And it's the fact that a witness who is neutral and has no reason to lie and no reason to shade testimony happens to recall something some way, that isn't proof that it happened that way. Because for good reasons, for totally non-suspicious reasons, memories change in little ways. And we can't just say, well, this person said this event happened on that date, good to go.
You're right. And I think that people won't say things unless they're asked a question about it, you know? And so it's, you know, there's
and
that,
the question
there's
itself,
that aspect too.
The
yeah.
By asking the question, you transform the result you get.
Right.
Like you can't measure something and get an accurate result at the same time.
That's right.
Without influencing it.
That's right. Colin, did you have anything you want to add before I go to the big question?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with Susan in the sense that the story could have been very similar if the students were first asked 6 days later because, yeah, eyewitness identification, eyewitness testimony, it's notoriously unreliable and there's so many problems with perception, narrative, and memory that, yeah, I mean, you could have framed it other ways. And I think it's interesting because you would say almost Serial was the first of its kind. The analogy I could think of would be the TV show 24. That was, if any of you watched that first season, they were initially only commissioned for 13 episodes. And you kind of felt in the second half of that first season, they were doing things on the fly and trying to figure things out. That's what the second half of Serial felt like a bit to me, where Sarah toward the end was, you know, piecing things together. And I think a lot of people were less satisfied with the second half of season one than the first half. And it seems to me with the second season that she consciously has everything in place ahead of time. Maybe that's why it took so long before she produced it. And so it's a very different thing to go in knowing what your end point is as opposed to sort of building toward that as the season progresses.
I'm just kind of hoping that Bo isn't the center of this story. Going forward, I am interested in the big picture of what I think she's going towards, but I don't really want to have another episode just talking about what Bo did and why he thinks he did what he did.
Oh, Colin, I'm curious. You know, you talk about this podcast being like expanding your law classroom. You know, my strong feeling about Serial Season 1, the service that I think it did, you know, aside from exposing things about the criminal justice system and talking about things that needed to be part of the conversation, and again, an incredibly timely conversation. I'm not 100% sure that Sarah knew how timely it would be when she began the project, was the sort of masterclass in journalism that we got. I mean, I can't recall another reporting project with so much transparency about reporting while the reporting's happening. So, for example, saying, I got a tip, I followed up on it, it's frustrating because I couldn't confirm it, so I'm leaving it out. Did you feel that way, or were you just frustrated and just wanted to know what the tip that she got was?
Yeah, but at the same time, I think we could all say on our behalves, there's several things that we know that we haven't reported, and there's been conversations amongst ourselves about, well, if we say this, it could lead to this witch hunt, and, well, we have this tip about Gutierrez, but we don't have enough confirmation yet. We don't want to report it. So, I mean, I certainly understand where Sarah was coming from in saying, I have information and I'm going to tell you I have some information, but I can't report on it more because I haven't found the confirmation. And it makes sense to me why she would keep certain things close to the vest.
Her story, too, was in a lot of ways her story of her investigation. So it was important to add as part of her story, basically, like her process. Here's what she went through. Here's what happened during the course of the investigation, and she had to check it out. And she didn't want to share whatever the rumor was because it really didn't add to the story itself. But it was an important part of the story of what she was going through.
Right. I mean, I think one of the things that we've talked about a lot on my show is it Adnan's story or Sarah's story? Ultimately, I would argue that given everything that's happened, I used to sort of lean toward the Sarah's story, but I'm kind of leaning back the other way now. I mean, look what's happened with your show and everything else that's been going on around the case in general. So, Rabia, I've got a big question that I'd like to ask each of you, but I kind of want to start with you, if you don't mind answering the question and as fully as you feel able to and want to. I think everyone wants to know if you guys have a theory about what happened on January 13th in 1999, a theory about the investigation, you know, your own spine of the story, Jay's role, the police, the prosecution, Christina Gutierrez. Do you have an answer that you look to as what you think is the closest to the truth?
Yeah, you know, and I look, you know, full disclosure, I mean, not that I hit it in any way when Serial began, but, you know, for 15, 16 years, me and Adnan's family, and I don't know, Adnan has never wanted to discuss it, but probably because of situation, but we always were like, you know, it's Jay. It has to be Jay, you know, because he had all this information that nobody else knew. How could he have that information? And it wasn't really until, you know, people sometimes will be critical online and say, oh, wow, you know, she changed her stance. Well, yeah, because I'm not an idiot. I mean, if I get new information, the smart thing to do is reassess your position. And I did, you know, with Susan and Colin's investigations and all this new information, I have completely reassessed my position. And I am at the point now where I think what happened on January 13th, the closest we can come to is that Hay was going to meet somebody she knew. There's a lot of different reasons I think that, but that she was definitely was going to meet somebody she knew. Something happened. It could have been an accident. I don't know. And she was hurt and killed. And it was probably in a private place. And many hours later, she was left in Lincoln Park. And the way in which she was left suggests that it was a very hasty kind of almost dumping of her body. And in terms of the case, the investigation, I think very early on, the police just really felt that it was Adnan, and not necessarily that they were pursuing something they thought didn't make sense. I think they knew, they really felt it was Adnan, and they had to just figure out how he did it. And that originally they thought he actually had the car and phone that day, so they were pursuing it like that. Then they realized that Jay had it, and they're like, crap, now what do we do? And they had to keep working it and working it until they could get this guy under, you know, threat of his own prosecution, conviction, charges, to just comply. And I really think Jay didn't know a thing. I mean, that's where I'm at now. I know maybe my conclusions are a little hard and fast, but I really, really do believe at this point that Jay knew absolutely nothing. And this is not unusual. It happens in plenty of cases. And we see this a lot in the media nowadays. Stories like this come forward, that Jay just had to save himself and his family and protect them and himself. And he had reason to believe that cooperating would lead to him being okay. And that's what happened. And so they had to fashion a case to get Adnan, and they did. And that's why the stories kept changing, and it is what it is.
Do you feel differently about Jay personally after sort of changing your mind and coming to this conclusion?
Not necessarily, because at the end of the day, even if he lied to protect himself, he knows that he's lying, and he lied, and he lied under oath. I mean, he knows this. Everybody knows this. And, you know, the only kind of measure of generosity I can give to Jay is that maybe the cops also convinced him that, listen, Adnan definitely did it. You have to help us nail him. He deserves to be where he is. If he has such a strong conviction as well, maybe he thought this is the right thing to do. But that's not justice. And from what I've heard from people who know Jay, they have told me unequivocally that it is almost impossible for Jay to ever come clean, that he is just, his personality is the kind that once he's dug in, he just digs in further. So, you know, initially I had hopes that maybe he would just finally say, yep, this is what happened. There was tapping. This is why I kept saying sorry. But I don't think that's going to happen anymore.
Colin, can I come to you with the same question? Do you have a spine of a story about what really happened the day that Hay disappeared?
Yeah, so I would say at this moment, my theory is this, that on January 13th in the morning, Adnan asked Hay for a ride. I think that there was a bit of a lie there. When I spoke to Krista, their mutual friend, she said that Adnan wouldn't tell her that he was letting Jay borrow the car. I think Adnan had the plan to let Jay borrow the car to buy drugs, and so he didn't reveal that. He made up some other excuse. Now, the ride itself, it could have been a ride home. It could have been a ride at track practice. It could have been, frankly, that he wasn't completely over her and wanted a chance to talk to her. But I think that there was some deception that was involved in the ride, which is why he's maintaining now that he never asked for a ride. I think between lunch and AP psychology class, someone got in contact with Hay. I think the best likelihood is someone paged her. That caused her to change her plans and to say after school, I can't give you a ride. Something else I have to do. Something came up. We have three witnesses who basically confirm that. We have Becky, we have Krista, and we have Aisha. And so basically I think that someone contacted her. Who are the candidates? Maybe someone who graduated from Woodlawn the year before. We obviously raised Don as the boyfriend being a possibility, someone we've never heard of before. But basically someone who wasn't a current student at Woodlawn caused her to change the plans. And I think that's the person who ended up taking her life, because otherwise, you know, imagine someone who had sent a message to Hay and said, can you hang out after school? Can you meet me here? Well, if Hay never appeared, why did that person not come forward then? Why have they not come forward now to say, I was supposed to meet with Hay on the afternoon, and that's the afternoon she disappeared. She never made the appointment. So I think that someone contacted her. That's the person who took her life. Obviously, if it's a graduate of Woodlawn who graduated the year before, which would explain why they're not at school, that could be someone Jay knew, which could explain how he has information. I don't think Jay was involved in the murder. I'm not sure whether his source of information was the police, whether it was someone he knew, whether, like Mr. S, there was sort of gossip going around. You know, the gossip led Mr. S to the body in Lincoln Park. Did that lead Jay to certain information like the location of the car? Did he in fact find the car? I'm not sure, but yeah. My theory is basically that Adnan asked for a ride, that it wasn't completely honest the way he asked for the ride, which is why he denies it now, but that regardless of that, something else came up for Hay at the end of the school day, and the person who made her change her plans, the person who has not come forward and said, I made her change her plans, is the person that took Hay's life.
Okay, Susan, we've heard two versions of what could have happened on January 13th, 1999. Do you have a theory that is the spine of the story for you?
I hate to rule anything out until I absolutely have to. I like to keep as many options alive until there's no longer any way I can support them and then slowly rule them out one by one. No, I'm nowhere near to one coherent story at this point. I guess, unlike Colin and Rabia, I'm still more open to the possibility that it was totally unconnected to anything in Hay's life, that this was a random crime. I don't think that's particularly likely, but I definitely think it's on the table still and something I don't rule out when assessing the evidence. I do think Adnan is innocent. The only scenario I can see that would come close at all to making him guilty is a scenario where he did it alone. He did it without Jay because he never needed Jay in the first place, and Jay's making everything up. But I've discounted that one too because, again, even with that big help, by rolling out Jay's stories, you make a lot more in play, you give a lot more leeway for what could have happened, but even then, I don't see a way Adnan could have done it. The timing doesn't work out, the evidence isn't there, so I feel pretty confident that he's innocent, and pretty much as confident that Jay wasn't involved either. I do agree with Colin. I think drug dealing has a lot more to do with this than's been mentioned in Serial or that we've discussed, because 16 years later, it's all speculation. But I do think very strongly that there was a very specific relationship between Adnan and Jay. They weren't friends. However, they were business partners of a sort. I think from the phone records, for instance, that it looks very clearly like on Wednesdays when Adnan had track, Jay borrowed Anand's car and phone and made calls to drug dealers, because you look at the records, you look at Wednesdays during the track time, and there's a very consistent pattern there. The calls during that time period are never to Anand's friends. They are to people that Jay got drugs from or that he did drugs with. So I think that explains what the plan was for why Jay had the car that day.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a lot. One of the things I think that people really would like to know, I know I would like to know, you've talked about the fact that you guys are moving on, that you're going to be doing something else with this podcast. And Susan, can you give us some idea of what that's going to look like, when it's going to happen, how it's going to kind of be brought out for the public to consume?
We're saying like late spring, early summer, but that's very tentative. We're kind of just in the early stages now of the case. The past month has been kind of crazy because I've been looking into the new case and trying to still do the last episodes for Anand's case. I think it'll be probably more likely summer. We'll see. It's another case, another murder case where, you know, the elements are so similar to Anand's case. I could just like give a summary and you couldn't tell if it was Anand's case or the new case. And it's not because the actual details are similar, but the type of evidence they use, the type of mistakes that were made, it's really like deja vu.
Colin, will you stay with the podcast when Susan moves on to the new case and the podcast moves on to new case? Will you stay with the show and be on the next season of Undisclosed 2?
Yeah, we just, Susan just uploaded a bunch of files for the season 2 case. And what I've really done at this point is to just look at the court opinions involved in the case. And yeah, as Susan said, there's a lot of similarities, and those similarities aren't just thematic or factual. There are legal issues that are very similar. And so I look forward to addressing some of those legal issues. In some senses, there's overlap and we'll be repeating points from the first season, but also there's other issues in this case of a legal nature that I look forward to sharing with an audience.
So, Rabia, you know, the podcast might be moving on to a new case. You guys have laid out in, you know, 30-odd episodes different facets of Adnan's case, missteps, misuse of evidence, you know, all kinds of different pieces, bits and pieces there. And there's still the legal proceeding yet to happen. And I'm wondering for you, the next season of Undisclosed coming up, I assume you're going to be involved, but what is the next chapter for you in terms of this case? And what are you thinking is going to happen? And what do you think the timing of that's going to be?
Yeah, well, I mean, first with the new case, you know, my look at the documents that Susan has sent along has been kind of superficial because I'm, as people might know by now, working on a book, really working with Adnan on a book in a way. And so I'm working on that along with the podcast and other things. But, you know, Undisclosed, Susan and Colin's work has done what, you know, Serial wasn't able to. And having said that, we couldn't have done anything without Serial having happened. I always think about this like in terms of, it almost took, they say it takes a village to raise a child, but it took like the world and, you know, like researchers from all parts of the world and you know, people online and just all kinds of pieces it took to get us this far in the actual legal case. But we are preparing for the post-conviction hearing that's been reopened and to present Asia as an alibi witness. And this is something that we have been trying for many years now. So I'm both nervous about it, but I am incredibly relieved to finally be able to get her in front of a judge and to let a judge decide in the face of what the state's presented, what Asia's testimony means for the case, and also assess what Gutierrez did and didn't do. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, Adnan's coming home anytime soon. It could be a number of years before this reaches any kind of real conclusion in terms of his freedom. And we all accept that. We know that.
So one of the things that I think as a radio producer, you know, I'd love to disclose to the audience is the way this podcast is put together. Rabia and Susan and Colin, you are all on Skype. You all have your own microphones and your own locations and your own computers. And, you know, one of the things that happens sometimes with Skype is that, you know, somebody will kind of turn their mic on to talk. And because their bandwidth has dipped, you know, you hear waves in the sound quality. Sometimes it sounds great like you're in a studio. Sometimes it sounds like you're on the phone. You know, there's just some sort of technical issues. But you also talked about how you collaborate on a script, an outline, and then you sort of riff on it when you're in the podcast. This is really one of the most interesting sort of collaborations, I think, and the way that it's being delivered that I've ever seen put together. And I'm wondering, how would you describe this collaboration? Is it a positive experience? Have you learned from it? Is it horrible? I'd just love to hear your thoughts.
No, it's been amazing. I mean, for me, it has, first of all, I mean, because my initial reaction, unlike Susan and Colin, was like, no, we cannot do a podcast. No, I cannot do a podcast. It's not even the realm of my, like, you know, reality. But it has been astonishing to me to see what can be done with technology, first of all of us being in different locations, how things are edited together. I have learned GarageBand. I have learned to use devices and applications that I never thought I would need to. And it's been an amazing process. And Susan and Colin are, I couldn't have like even imagined like better partners on something like this. I mean, I'll be honest, and this is like full disclosure, like 95% of the script writing is Susan and Colin. Even before I can get around to thinking about it, Colin's like, I just drafted together something. Or Susan's like, I just put up a draft and it'll be like 35 pages long with like citations. I'm like, crap. They're amazing. And I don't know how Colin blogs every single day. And I don't know how Susan catches every little thing that nobody thinks about. And I think somehow the three of us are just working together. I am the smallest cog in this machine. And so I'm in awe of what they can do and what's come together. And even, you know, the way that, you know, our music has been produced and created by people who did it voluntarily. And, you know, our logo was like that. You know, the website is Susan's husband putting it together. Rebecca, what you've brought to the podcast has like literally taken us up notches and notches in production. It has been an amazing experience for me. And I just feel like if this is something like a new model, then people need to, it just shows that anything can be done. I mean, I feel like this can be done like globally. You could work with people across the globe to create something like this.
Okay, Colin, I dare you to say something negative now after that about this collaboration.
No, it's been great. And I was just sort of scrolling through a second ago the old emails that we were exchanging basically about the time of episode one and episode two. And, you know, we're talking about how, well, maybe we need to script out exactly what we're saying or have signals as to when each person should speak. And the whole idea of, well, we really don't have it together enough where we can have a free-flowing conversation, maybe record separate segments and splice them together. And just to see the growth that we've had throughout this process where it's really been a true collaboration. I think the great thing about it is each of us brings a very distinct skill set to the table, and that has allowed us to grow and develop. And I think the feedback we've gotten has been that there's been improvement gradually throughout the process. And I just think it's been a really great experience for me to work with two people who are just very supportive and are extremely intelligent and do a really great job of both putting things together and editing. And so it's been a really wonderful experience. I've really enjoyed the time that I've spent in working on the podcast with two great people.
Okay, Susan, what are your thoughts on this collaboration?
We have come such a long way. I almost only want to go through the old emails and see like how how over our heads we were, and how it was cute how we focused on details that like probably didn't matter. Like, what are we going to say to like transition between different people talking? But it's been great. And it's a cliche to say, but we kind of just make a really good team. This whole project was more or less an accident. And I think just by chance, we had three people with three fairly different skill sets that turn out to work really well together. Unexpectedly. I can't say I'd really want to take on a project of this scope with two random people, or that I expected to go well if we did, but in this case, it's been really great.
It has been an amazing, mind-boggling whirlwind of a year. Since the start of Serial in October of 2014 until now, the entire landscape of the case has changed. I've barely had the time to get my head above water, but every so often, in quiet moments, it hits me. For the first time ever, after nearly 17 years in prison, Adnan finally has a chance at justice. And for the first time in a long time, we see a possibility that he might be able to have a real life and not die in prison. What Sarah and the Serial team did for Adnan's case, bringing his story to the entire world, can never be repaid or repeated enough. They set in motion the events that would flip the case on its head by forcing the attention of people across continents to a state-level homicide case, because really that's what this case is. Without Sarah's masterful storytelling, Asia would never have re-entered the scene, Jay and Yurik wouldn't have given damning interviews, and perhaps most importantly, Susan and Colin may never have been compelled to investigate and write about the case. Without Susan and Colin and our many listeners and supporters who've been right there with us in the trenches, doing research and digging up leads, we would not have uncovered evidence that destroyed the state's timeline, that dismantled its cell tower evidence, and then unveiled the truth about a star witness. I don't know how, on behalf of all of those who love and care about Adnan, to thank the many, many people it's taken to get this far. From Sarah, to Justin, to Susan, Colin, Dennis, Amar, Rebecca, Bob, Ben, amazing Reddit researchers, you know who you are, Patrick, Ramiro, Christy, Dez, Chris, Methil, and of course, Baluki. Most importantly, our listeners and supporters, every single person has been vital to the success of Undisclosed and the success of Adnan's motion to reopen his appeal hearing. One of the hardest things over the years for me, and I'm sure Adnan's family and other loved ones, has been the sheer powerlessness of his situation. During his trial, Adnan spoke just a few times. Once to confirm that he wouldn't testify at the advice of his lawyer. Second, after his conviction, when he asserted his innocence. And lastly, during his sentencing, when he maintained his innocence. I felt painfully aware that even during Serial, his voice, how much we heard and what we heard, was not in his control. And during Undisclosed, we haven't heard from him at all. Not because we didn't want him to be part of the podcast or that he didn't want to be part of it, but because after his recorded interviews with Sarah, he was told that he would lose his phone privileges permanently if he did another recorded interview. So while I speak to him fairly regularly, we couldn't and wouldn't take the chance of recording him. He is already housed many hours away from his family in a supermax prison, and the risk of losing his phone privileges permanently and being nearly cut off from the world is simply not worth it. I have hope, though, real hope, that we'll hear a lot from him soon when he's finally out. Now, as many of you may know, I'm writing a book about the case in the past 17 years, which will in fact have Adnan's own words and contributions, and that gives me a great sense of relief that his voice will finally be heard on his own terms. You can find details about pre-ordering the book, which will be released in September, on my personal site, rabiatjadhavi.com. Now, one last announcement. On March 5th, 2016, the Adnan Syed Legal Trust is hosting a Night for Justice Gala in downtown Baltimore. This banquet will benefit the trust and also benefit both the Undisclosed and Truth and Justice podcasts. It's going to bring together all of us who've been working on this case. Susan, Colin, Bob Ruff, our many volunteers, Adnan's legal team, his family and friends, the Undisclosed musicians, and notable leaders in the criminal justice reform movement. This will be an evening to honor and thank those who've put in hundreds of hours of work for Adnan's case and for other wrongful convictions as well. Seats are limited, but we'd love for you to join us for a beautiful evening, to come meet us, enjoy a great dinner and program. If you'd like to get tickets and join us, you'll find the information on my website, rabiatjadhavi.com. We're also going to put it up on our Undisclosed website and tweet it and put it on our Facebook page. Lots of different ways you'll get the information. Now, I want to end by wishing our listeners, on behalf of the entire Undisclosed team, a very happy, peaceful, and prosperous new year. Thank you again for taking this journey with us. For all of your support, suggestions, questions, donations. But don't worry, though, the journey isn't over yet. We'll be back soon enough with an engrossing new case of murder and justice denied. Next time on Undisclosed.
I've gotten, yeah, not so many, but I've probably gotten like maybe 3 or 4 complaints over the course of this show, uh-huh, of people losing their shit about you saying, I'm joined with instead of joined by.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I find it hilarious every time.
Stop it. God damn, sorry. My cat's deciding to be a hole again. I'll move him.
I really, at some point, want to capture that typing and maybe put it in that reel that we're going to do for... I'm not kidding. I'm actually...
And the Cosme case seemingly makes clear that she was out of the country. Well, no, she wasn't.
Oh, well, she was...
yeah.
She was in Puerto Rico, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going... This is going to be a long episode, I think, you know?
This is our creative process, just silence, silent meditation. It's always Colin and Susan who come up with like the exact right and all, usually
trying to think of something snappy. Yeah, but
yeah. And the last thing you have is the affidavit in support of the warrant for the search of your client's house, which took place on March 20th, 1999. That affidavit provides.
Sorry. My left foot is.
You okay?
I'm sorry. I did not know my mic was on. Yes, my left foot is asleep. I'm so sorry. Okay. I've got a friend in the closet with me who's observing, and this is, it's complicated. Sorry, guys. Okay, I apologize. You'll have to start that over. I'm muting myself now. Bye.